Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Jane Berkey and Natalie Mandelblatt are interviewing Nancy Frank on Wednesday, November 12, 1975. Nancy, would you first give us your full name?
Yes, it's Nancy Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N, Frank, R-A-N-K.
Tell me first about your immediate family, your father, your mother.
Well, my father was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my mother in Athens, Ohio. They're both deceased, of course. And what would you like to know about them?
Well, first, their full names.
Oh, well, my father was Frederick Newman. My mother was Sophie Half Newman.
And do you remember their dates of birth?
Not offhand. They would both be, if they were living, they would both be, well, in their 90s. Because they were in their 30s when I was born and I'm 65. I wouldn't remember the, I remember their birthdays, but not their birthday.
Do you remember your grandparents?
Oh, very clearly. I remember my grandparents more clearly than I remember my father, because my father died when I was 3.5 years old. But my paternal grandparents, who lived in Milwaukee, I remember very clearly. My paternal grandmother was a third or fourth generation American. Her ancestor had come to Milwaukee in the very early part of the 19th century. In fact, we have a big joke in the family about him that it was the biggest flimflam since Peter Stuyvesant, because he's owned at one time what was all downtown Milwaukee now and sold it for, I don't know, $20, something like that, and thought he made a good deal. You know, but for label Rinse Cup, we'd all be multimillionaires now, so we make a joke about him. But she had lived in Milwaukee for she and her family for several generations. Her husband, my grandfather, came from Germany in the latter part of the 19th century to avoid military conscription, as many young men did, and he was very proud of the fact that he had $5 in his pocket when he got off the boat and made it the hard way.
What type of business was he in?
He was a wholesale liquor dealer, and was in business with his brother-in-law, who was my grandmother's brother, and they retired at the time of Prohibition and apparently had made enough that they were able to retire and live on the interest of their proceeds, because neither one of them worked after that.
And when did your mother first come to Pittsburgh from Milwaukee?
No, my father was born in Milwaukee and lived there as a young man. Was educated at the University of Wisconsin, and he was an electrical engineer. And like many young men did in those days, this was around the turn of the century, he came to Westinghouse for a year's postgraduate work. My mother's family had moved here from Ohio in the latter part of the 19th century, sometime in the 1890s, lived on the north side in what was then Allegheny, as many Jewish families did. I think probably your family did too, Jane. And there was a family connection there. I don't know how interesting this is to your project, but my father's uncle married my mother's first cousin. So through that connection, when he came to Pittsburgh, the families got together, and I guess that's how they fell in love, and he courted my mother. Then when he was finished with his work at Westinghouse, they moved to Chicago. He was a manufacturer of electrical automobiles. He was an engineer, and Westinghouse still holds many of his patents. See, James, learning all this for the first time. In fact, my cousin, Irving Half, about 5 or 10 years ago, was so interested in this that he looked up some of his patents and found them He had patented a hub motor. He had patented the electric bell on the electric automobile. So he went from here to Chicago and worked for the Woods Electric Company, who were manufacturers of electric automobiles. And then, shortly before his very sad premature death, he had started his own manufacturing company, the Chicago Electric Company. And then he died of malignancy in his early 30s. And my mother remained on in Chicago for about 10 years after that, and then moved back to Pittsburgh because this was her.
You were born in Chicago?
I was born in Chicago. My older brother was born in Chicago.
Now, what is your brother's name?
Irving Daniel.
And there were just the two of you?
Just the two of us.
And how old were you when your mother moved back to Pittsburgh?
Well, I went to Shenley High School and entered the 11th grade there, so that will tell you. I was 16 years old.
What was your home atmosphere like when you were a child? Was it religious or?
Oh, well, my family in Chicago were members of Sinai Congregation, which was the extreme right wing of Reform Judaism. To the point where when I came here and went to Rosh Hashanah, I thought I was in an Orthodox shul. Would you believe that we didn't even have Saturday services at Sinai? The main service of the week was Sunday morning, and this was it. The rabbi of that congregation had been the famous Emil G. Hirsch, who was one of the founders of Reform Judaism and one of the great scholars of Reform Judaism. So within the limit of that orientation, I would say we were very religious Jews. And I often talk about this here at the agency now, because when people refer to my mother, they'll say, oh, I didn't know she was Reform. I thought your mother was a very religious woman. And this is something that really gets to me. She was a very religious woman, but she was a Reform Jewess. And my grandmother, so we haven't talked about my maternal grandparents. My maternal grandmother was born in Alsace and came to this country in the early part of the last century. In fact, she was very fond of telling us that as a young girl, when she first came to Philadelphia, she saw President Lincoln. And she was quite dumbfounded because here was this plain man in a plain suit with a plain hat, and she expected him to look like royalty, having come from Europe. But as all people in Europe were, she came from an Orthodox background. Her father had been a Hebrew teacher. And when she was a bride and went to Athens, Ohio, to live, they tried hard to observe the Orthodox tradition still. In fact, she told me at one time that they observed kosher and had meat sent in from Cincinnati, which was the nearest place where supposedly kosher butchers were. And then after a period of time, they found they'd been flim-flammed, and the meat wasn't really kosher after all, so they gave it up. To that extent, she was a devout as well as religious person. I think one can be one without the other. And I remember going to temple with her as a child, and she was never satisfied to let the rabbi do the work. She always had to read the whole service for herself. And she read English very well, but she was always about a sentence or two behind the rabbi. So we always observed Shabbos. And, I guess I'm still guilty when I sew a button on Saturday, because this was something that you weren't supposed to do. And, it was all right to do certain things like go to town to shop, but I wasn't allowed to cut out paper dolls on Saturday. Well, does that give you enough picture of the kind of
our farm.
Religious background.
Would you tell us a little, excuse me, about the economic circumstances?
Well, that's a little hard to do. I suppose one might say that I had a privileged childhood, as I compare it with many things that I have seen since in my work. Naturally, my mother's circumstances were reduced by the fact of her very early widowhood. In fact, she went to work about 5 to 10 years after my father died, which was rather unusual for women in those days, and rather unusual in the way she found herself a job. It was quite a feather in her cap, I think. But I can't recall ever being economically deprived. There was always money on both sides of the family, not enormous amounts of money, but we lived comfortably. We had domestic help, as people did in those days. We traveled, we went on vacations in the summer, not to Europe, but to Michigan or Wisconsin or Atlantic City. We traveled back and forth to Pittsburgh and spent a lot of time in Milwaukee with my paternal grandparents, so that while we were certainly not enormously wealthy people, we always managed to take it for granted all the children would go to college.
Would you tell us about how your mother did catch her child?
Yes, I'd be glad to. My mother was not a college graduate, which was something that I think she had a lot of regret about, because she was a woman with many cultural interests. And she had always been particularly interested in handcrafts and handwork of any kind. And this was when we were still living in Chicago. And she saw that a woman was going to be showing some Kentucky handmade quilts at the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago, which was then a very nice hotel. And so she went down just to see them, really had no intention of buying anything. And the woman's name was Eleanor Beard. Mrs. Beard had been a Southern debutante who had married an older man who was a Kentucky sheep raiser, and lived in this small town of Hardinsburg, Kentucky, was very bored there, and one time when the wool market was going broke, she said to her husband, "I'll buy your wool." He thought she was crazy. And she went to the cottages of some of the women whom she had known there and had observed their work and made up designs and had them make up quilts, and went to New York and showed them in the most fashionable shops there and came back with orders for I don't know how many handmade quilts and comforters. So that she began this business, and she began showing in various hotels, and my mother went down to see her and was just interested in the craft itself. And as she was there and as she was visiting with her, Mrs. Beard became very busy. A lot of customers came in, and my mother just picked up and started waiting on the trade. And when the afternoon calmed down, she said, "Mrs. Newman, how would you like to be my Chicago representative?" And my mother said, "I would love it." She'd never worked a day in her life. So that was how she started to work. And she sold these things. They were all custom made from, your grandmother had them, your mother had them, from, they were all custom made from patterns and swatches that the representative showed. And my mother used to show in different hotels, and then when she moved to Pittsburgh, she became the Pittsburgh representative, and eventually Mrs. Beard opened a shop in Chicago. She stopped selling through department stores and opened shops in New York, Chicago, Palm Beach, places like that. And then mother used to show the things here at the Shelley Hotel and at Sewickley and the Inn, and she went to Cleveland and Rochester, Atlantic City. In fact, I used to go with her when I was in college. It was fun. And so this was what she did, which was really quite unusual for a woman of her background to be employed. Jane would understand this because she was a contemporary, a little bit older, but a contemporary of Jane's grandmother, and she was unique among her friends and family and being employed, but she loved it. She met all kinds of fabulous people and the most interesting customers, and she just loved it.
And a lot of this must have been reflected in yours and your brother's life.
Well, only to the extent, I suppose, that it added a certain dimension to our lives. I know that I went with her and got into homes I never would have seen otherwise. For instance, when the Mesta family, I think, still lived in the Mesta mansion on Beechwood Boulevard, I went with her once when she was taking some measurements there, this sort of thing. Otherwise, I don't suppose it had a major impact on our lives. I enjoyed going with her as a vacation kind of thing, but I would never have wanted to do it as a job. I don't think I would have done it very well. I didn't have the flair for it. She almost had to be a decorator.
You had mentioned that she had many cultural interests. Mm-hmm. Did you enumerate them for her?
Well, she loved music and she loved ballet, and she certainly gave me. She took me to see Pavlov when I was 4 years old in Chicago. The Edelweiss Gardens, which was an outdoor beer garden designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Perfectly beautiful. I was only about 4 years old. I remember it distinctly because it was the first time I ever saw a woman smoke a cigarette. I think that made as much impression on me as Pavlov. She danced outside, and all I remember was just this white vision. And then when I was a little older, Pavlov came back. She was the sort of woman who would have done anything that she wanted to do, even if she had to do it on her own. So she went to see Nijinsky dance when he came because she wanted to do it. And it didn't bother her at all that no one would have gone with her. She liked music, liked the theater, she liked to read. My grandmother, the one who was born in France, was a great reader. She always had to have a book at hand. In fact, among the few arguments that she and I used to have when I was growing up was who would get to the book first.
Did you live near them while you were still in?
My maternal grandmother lived with us. She was a widow. I never knew my maternal grandfather. He died around the time my mother was married. So she lived with us after my father died, or I think maybe even before my father died. My memory isn't too clear on that. She shuttled back and forth between Chicago and Pittsburgh because she had four sons married and living here, but her really permanent home was with us.
Can you make any contrast between your home in Chicago and when you came to Pittsburgh on a cultural, political level?
No, not really. Very much the same thing. No.
In Chicago, did you live in an area that was also had many Jewish families?
Some Jewish families. We lived on the south side then, near Jackson Park. And I would say, this was when I was very small, it was right near the lake, and it was very lovely for that reason, because the lake was our backyard, and we could swim there anytime we wanted. And I would say that not all of my friends were Jewish, and there were enough Jewish people in the neighborhood that we didn't feel separate or different, but it was not predominantly Jewish.
And what was your school like?
In Chicago?
Yes, your grade school first.
Well, the first couple of years, I went to a small private Episcopal school. And that was very protected. The women who ran the school in those days, they didn't have school buses, but they walked around and picked up all the children and accompanied us to school. And through that, I really got put a year ahead of myself. And I think, honestly, that my family didn't quite understand the extent of church influence in the school. And I think that had some reason for my being taken out and put into a public school, because they gave prizes at the end of the year. And I got a crucifix, not a crucifix, a cross, to wear around my neck which I was very proud of because it was for scholastic excellence. And when I came home and wanted to wear it, my grandmother was slightly horrified and said, well, she thought it would be nice to give it to Mary because we had an Irish Mary at that time. And I burst into tears. I don't remember this, but I remember being told about it and was told, well, Jesus died to save us. Why do I have to give him away? So I had been pretty well indoctrinated without actually the family realizing it. And there was this embarrassment because we used to have to kneel for prayer. And we wore white stockings in those days. And I would come home with dirty knees. And I knew there was something not quite kosher about this because I was afraid to tell my mother why I had dirty knees in my stockings. But I got a very good academic grounding so that when I went to public school, I was a year ahead of myself. And then I went to a small public school in Chicago, which was a branch school and which was a building left over from the World's Columbian Exposition. It had been built as a model school. And let me tell you, by the time we got there, it was no model anymore. It was a small school where they had, like the Davis School here, just the first, second, and third grades for the children in that area. And then I changed to the Ray School, which was a typical public school in Chicago at that time. Some children from quite advantaged homes, some from quite disadvantaged. Then I went to Hyde Park High School, which is one of those high schools in Chicago, like Shelley here, that has a lot of famous graduates. And after 2 years, transferred here.
Was there much of a racial or ethnic mix in the junior high and high school?
So it wasn't a junior high. You went 8 grades and then you went to regular high school. We had very few black children at the race school. Very few. And then my first year of high school, I again went to a branch school. It was the local branch of the Hyde Park High School. And I distinctly remember only one black student in my class. Interesting, I can still remember her name. It made such an impression.
Other than that, though, there was a wide racial, ethnic mixture?
Yes, I would say so. Good mix of Jewish and non-Jewish. Certainly, again, enough Jewish students that we didn't feel separate or different, but also enough that I didn't grow up exclusively. Which is about the same as what it was when I went to Shelley High School here in the United States.
Do you remember much about their system of discipline? Or?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I do remember, which may be interesting to you because it would tell you something about attitudes toward blacks in those days. This was in Chicago, and this was in my Latin class, and in those days they
Nancy,
used to...
Nancy, can I just hold you on this for 1 minute?
Alright. We were seated in some classes in accordance with our grades. This was a mark of distinction if you had the first seat. And there was one black boy, Alonzo Mead, in my class in second year Latin, Caesar. And I remember after a test being given the first and Alonzo being given the second. And when I went over my paper, I noticed that there was a mistake which the teacher had not corrected. And I went up to her and told her, and it made the difference between Alonzo getting the first seat and me. And I didn't say anything to the teacher, but it crossed my mind at that time, and we were not racially conscious of all that, as to whether this had been a deliberate omission on her part because she didn't want Alonzo in the first seat. Now, why did that thought occur to me? I don't know, and I could have been altogether wrong, but it did occur to me, and he did get the first seat. Now, I don't know what this tells you about how people were thinking and feeling in those days, but there was enough there that I was conscious of this, that there could have been a prejudice.
What were you thinking of?
I think English always, and Latin, and certainly not math. Had to be two to get through that. I would say clearly English. I don't know. I think in high school then, I don't know how it is now, how well one liked a subject was usually a function of the quality of teaching. If you had a good English teacher, you liked your English class. And when I came to Shenley High School, I had two superlative English teachers, really three. And I think that had a lot to do with it.
Were there anything comparable to the enrichment programs they have now for the better students?
Program was so enriched. We had such bright students in our class. Gladys Schmidt was in our class. Dallin Ritchie was in our class. Jack Rothschild sat in front of me in English class. So that it just naturally enriched itself because there were so many bright students there. And I would say that Elmer Kenyon, who was a very well-known person in this community, taught English, one of the 11th grade classes, and we studied Macbeth. And I'm sure that I remember and learned as much or more about Macbeth from Elmer Kenyon, who was a very theater-minded person, than I did from any courses I took at CMU. And the same was true of Fred Homer, who taught English, and another woman whose name I can't remember, who really taught me to love poetry. So the classes just naturally enriched themselves because of the high standard of teaching and the high caliber of students. We just had brilliant people.